This is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. Julian Scher is back to talk about his newest book, One Child at a Time, The Global Fight to Rescue Children from Online Predators. It's a gripping and engrossing book about crimes that put every child who uses the internet at risk. The internet has become a place where creeps who create and exchange child porn flourish. The pedophiles and predators meet, encourage, and mentor one another as they abuse countless numbers of children, including infants. Scher deftly tells the stories of the abusers and the abused, as well as the many in law enforcement and big business working to stamp out these insidious and disgusting crimes. The book, $34.95 from Random House, also includes resources for parents. I spoke with Julian Scher earlier this week when he was in Vancouver.
Pleased to welcome once again to the Plant on the Line program, Julian Scher. Good morning, Mr. Scher.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
This book is an interesting book. It's also a very troubling one, but a necessary one. When you were on last year about Angels of Death, you mentioned that you were working on this. How did this come about?
Well, it came about because of my work with bikers and biker gang investigations. I was at a writing event, an awards dinner, and I happened to be sitting at a table that was sponsored by Microsoft Canada. And they said, well, look, as a true crime writer, you should check out what we're doing with police. And I said, excuse me? What was Microsoft doing with police? And that led me to the story that's featured in the book, where a Toronto police officer, the head at the time of Canada's largest child porn investigation unit, was so frustrated with the amount of not only the garbage flooding the internet, but the evidence that his people were collecting. They were drowning in it. There were like 3 million images they had collected in the last year. He decided to do what every angry computer user only dreams to do, which is to send an angry email to none other than Bill Gates. Well, he forgot about it, but Bill Gates didn't. Bill Gates actually responds to the email, and he tells, as I recount in the book, he tells Microsoft Canada to meet with the police. And the result of that, over several years, Microsoft invests several million dollars and works closely with the police to develop what becomes known as the Child Exploitation Tracking System. It was just one example in the book of positive ways that police and corporations, and then eventually parents and other groups, are trying to deal with what I call the new face of crime in the 21st century.
This is Paul Gillespie you're talking about, correct?
That's right. At the time, Detective Sergeant Paul Gillespie.
Where is he now?
Paul stepped down, retired. Actually, retired isn't quite the right word. He turned in his badge, but he's continuing the exact same fight. He's working full-time as a consultant, helping to train police around the world in tracking online predators, working to train people in the use of KETS, the Microsoft database program. I'm going to be speaking shortly with him at a major fundraising event for child safety.
Do you find, though, amongst law enforcement agencies, because this is a worldwide problem, that there are battles over jurisdiction, or do you find a lot of cooperation amongst themselves?
It's actually the reverse. You're right. Classic police work is very territorial. You know, the body's on the other side of the sidewalk. That's Station 51's problem, not our problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, because the crime knows no borders, a Toronto police officer, a Vancouver police officer, a Halifax police officer, stumbling across a cache of internet child porn is going to have no reason to think that those children are necessarily in his own backyard. And what's actually encouraging is how the police chiefs, the police commanders have given the permission for their squads to go and rescue these children regardless of where they are, knowing that sooner or later some of it will also spin back into their own backyard. That's actually what happened in Edmonton. I tell the story in the book of an Edmonton police officer who starts working with a child predator who's arrested and convicted of abusing his own children, but decides to want to help the police uncover this wider international porn ring. Well, after infiltrating the group and going undercover and investigating how this worldwide group is exchanging videos of children, where does the investigation lead back? Right back to Edmonton, where one of the key administrators of the secret chat room is centered. So it was a good example where they thought widely, they were willing to cross jurisdictions, and in the end, it landed up solving a crime in their own backyard.
Looking at the Canadian example, are our law enforcement officials, do they have the resources necessary to combat this problem, do you think?
Well, yes and no. I think overall they've made huge progress, so much so that in many ways Canada's considered path breakers when it comes to investigating online child predators. One with the CETS, with the Child Exploitation Tracking System. This is a huge database Microsoft has built that allows police to coordinate and make connections between pieces of evidence that they wouldn't normally be able to connect. To give you one example, a man uses a postal code in his exchanges with another online predator in England. Meanwhile, the U.S. in New Jersey does a major international bust and finds people who are using their credit card. Well, Ketz was able to put together parts of a postal code from those two cases and connect it to a man in Toronto. The police go, arrest him, find pictures on his camera of a young girl that he's molesting who lives in the Ontario area, and she ends up being rescued. So it's an example where police are doing some real frontier stuff. Now we have for the first time a national center in Ottawa that's trying to coordinate this work. One of the things they're working on, which we still don't have in Canada, is a kind of image database, kind of what you see on CSI, that could instantly look at pictures and crunch them down and try to figure out what is a new picture, where have we seen this picture before, what other clues are there in pictures. So I think police are constantly trying to keep ahead of the technological curve.
But for every good story, for every arrest, for every conviction, there must be countless more, correct?
Absolutely. And there are plenty of good stories. I mean, the book focuses on good stories. There are more than 1,000 children who've been named, identified, and rescued. But police figure that's a small percentage of what's out there. Now, on the one hand, the good stories are the ones that keep the police going. And also, every life saved is very important. But I think police also realize that this is never a war they're going to win in policing alone. This is never a war they're going to win only on the technological battlefront. Because the predators are doing this 24/7. The predators are the ones who live and breathe this stuff. Police will go on to other assignments and other squads. So I think police are realizing that they have to enlist the media, politicians, communities and schools, and probably most important, the parents themselves and children. They're realizing that we have to, take back the Internet as a playground because it has become the world's biggest playground.
So what can we do? What can parents do?
It's an excellent question. I think several things. I think, first of all, wake up and smell the coffee. Realize that while the Internet is by far the most glorious communication tool we've ever invented, and it's a wonderful learning experience for children, like any other tool, there are dangers out there, and you have to be aware of them. You know, be aware that 70% of children have been approached online by somebody that they don't know. Street-proof your children so that they know not to give out their names and numbers to a stranger, only to communicate online with a friend from school, a friend from the local softball team, somebody that they know. Especially younger children, make sure that that computer is in a public part of the house. You wouldn't send your child out, an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old child, to play alone at the park after dark. Why would you send them to their bedroom to play on their computer by themselves without supervision and also basic guidance? Then with teenagers, it's a bit of a different story, right? Because if you tell teenagers not to do something, that's the first sure sign that they'll go ahead and do it. They're bound to be rebellious. They want to explore, and they should explore and be adventurous about their own sexuality and the Internet. So there it's a question of appealing to their maturity and saying, you're in control of your surfing habits, not your parents, not your teachers, but also not the predators, right? Here are some basic tips you could do. Here are some basic security measures. Again, the same things for teenage girls and boys, right? Don't give out your name unless you know somebody. Don't meet online. Don't meet in real life anybody you've only met online. Here's a frightening statistic, Joseph. 10% of the images they're finding in child porn raids now in the United States are self-produced. Pictures that the teenagers are taking themselves.
So someone online provokes them to do that?
That's right. Now, it could be, a boyfriend after a nasty breakup puts pictures of his girlfriend up for revenge. But more and more what it is a lonely teenage girl sitting in her basement communicating with a newfound buddy. somebody she thinks is her boyfriend, lands up being an older man. I tell the story of one of the star FBI agents in my book who does all kinds of classic undercover work, but now is spending more and more time dealing with these teenage girls who have found themselves trapped by a stranger online.
Now, I realize we haven't really defined for those of us who are listening to us, Julian, what these crimes are. Is it child pornography?
That's right.
Pedophilia. Are they one and the same?
No, they're not, in the sense that several myths people have about pedophilia to start with. Pedophiles are not all pedophiles are child molesters. Not all child molesters are pedophiles. Pedophiles is the sexual preference you have for children who are prepubescent, usually under, 11, 12, or 13 years of age. This is a sexual preference. You might molest children, or you might be able to control your urges, just like somebody can become a nun, and be chaste. What your sexual preference doesn't necessarily mean that this is the sex you're going to practice. Child molesters are not all pedophiles. Some do it because they're opportunistic. They're angry. They want to attack somebody. It just happens to be a child. But pedophiles have this lifetime affliction, and unless they get treatment, they will always have this. And most pedophiles also know about this before they're 18, because it kicks in at puberty when all of our sexual preferences kick in. Here's an interesting fact. Most people also associate pedophiles with gays, with homosexuality. Dead wrong. Over 90% of the men who are, over 90% of the people who are arrested for these charges are men, but 70 to 80% of the pictures found on these computers are of young girls. So pedophilia is not connected, is not caused by homosexuality in any way. But the definition question you raised is a real important one, because the very term child pornography is actually quite problematic. Because the word pornography implies, that's the word you have to use because that's what's in our legislation, that's what it's called in our laws, but it's the wrong word. In Australia, they called it child exploitation material. And that's right, because think about it. What is pornography? Pornography is a moral choice. Pornography is about usually consensual, often professional people getting paid to engage in some kind of sex act. You could be for it or against it. That's up to society to make moral judgments. It's not illegal. This is not pornography. These are children, and here's a shocking statistic. 40% of the children portrayed in these child pornography images are, believe it or not, under 5. Think about that.
That's right? Disgusting.
So this has nothing to do with sex or eroticism, right? This is straight out torture and abuse of children.
Now, those that create these images, they're obviously criminal. Now, if you're exchanging these images online, a place that you talk about in the book, Landslide, which made $10 million a year, mm-hmm. run by this couple out of Dallas, Janice and Thomas Reedy, creating these images, or just...
No, not at all. Purely in it for business. Crime like nature abhors a vacuum, smart, devious producers, webmasters, and also organized crime, Russian and East European organized crime, realized, hey, think of the money you could make, right? Moving drugs is dangerous, it's hard, you actually have to ship, a physical product, get it through customs, and if you get charged and convicted, you're going away for a long time. Pictures, right, are easy to move. you could hide millions of them in a little USB flash drive, and if you get caught, in most countries, you're going to get nothing more than a slap on a wrist, and you can make a fortune on it. So that is one of the new frontiers that police are trying to deal with, how to deal with the commercialization of this kind of product.
One story you talk about in the book that I found particularly gripping was that of Anne. And that's not her real name, of course.
That's right. It's a great story because I think it shows many things. It shows, first of all, how the predators you have to worry about are the ones we don't know about. Anne was a 9-year-old girl working at a school called Walt Disney Elementary near South Bend, Indiana. She was being abused by the most popular teacher in the school. Everybody loved this teacher. He was in line to be the next principal. She eventually discloses her abuse to her parents. Her parents believed her, and one enterprising police detective believes her. But most other people don't, because she was a bit of a troublemaker. The teacher was loved. Well, this police officer using the new technology, using the tremendous databases that the police now have at hand, using their storage and tracking email addresses, were eventually able to find old postings this teacher had put on the web of this girl. And after an 18-month investigation, he gets arrested. He gets charged. But now he's facing 30 years in jail. And what happens? This brave little girl, who's now a young teenager, agrees to come forward and testify. It's not required. He had already confessed, but she wanted to read a victim impact statement. And she stands up in the court, and the judge is crying, and the prosecutor is crying, and Anne's little hands are shaking, the paper is shaking, as she reads this strong condemnation of this teacher and says, you abused my trust. I trusted you. Now I know that there is evil in the world, she says, but I will be strong, because I have to be strong. So it's a great story of her redemption.
You're reading the story and you're shaking your fist, just, you know,
absolutely,
for the great conclusion. Yeah. Now, how long did he get in prison?
30 years. In the States, they take this rather seriously. I'm sad to say that I think in Canada we haven't quite woken up to the fact that the taking of pictures is a crime scene photo. The children had to be abused for these pictures to be taken, and our laws have a far way to go still.
Now, there was one, I forget now the story in the book, but there was one one individual was caught and he had 6 years in prison. Is that usually what the sentence is?
That's generous. In Canada, certainly for just the distribution and downloading of pictures, for downloading pictures, if you're found with pictures, you'll often get just a conditional sentence.
Like Pete Townsend, right?
That's right. And it's not the realization that pictures themselves can become fuel for offending. You're participating in a crime because a child had to be abused for you to look at those pictures. But even for direct hands-on abuse, sentences can often be quite lenient in Canada. But there's a reverse to that as well. I mean, we have this weird situation where on the one hand, we don't take it seriously enough, so we're not handing out the kind of severe sentences that are needed. But at the other hand, we're also not offering the treatment that's necessary. These guys are not bank robbers. You send them to jail, a bank robber after a while may say, you know what, it's not worth robbing banks. I'm going to keep going back in the slammer. I've got to find another line of work. A pedophile can't change, you know, his preference for children. That's, you know, hardwired into his system, or he's learned it. But he can control it the same way an alcoholic can decide, I am not going to take another bottle. But that alcoholic has to have treatment, and that alcoholic has to want to change. And we're not offering that to the pedophiles.
Is that something government then should look into?
Absolutely, because, you know, one doctor I talked to explains how this is a public health dilemma in Canada. 2 to 7% of men, he estimates, have pedophilic tendencies. Even if we arrest somebody and send them away for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, he's going to come out, he's still going to be a pedophile, unless we could offer treatment that's going to train him to control his urges.
You talked earlier about Microsoft and the work that they've done developing a database and so on. Have other big corporations, have you seen much the same, or is there an apprehension?
I think there's partly apprehension, and I think also it's a very mixed bag. Microsoft has definitely stepped to the fore. AOL in the United States has gone forward way beyond what is legally required, and are going out of their way to do the best that they can in terms of tracking this information and passing it on to the authorities. But here in Canada, for example, ISPs are not required by law to report. They're not required by law to block. They have finally worked on a blocking system, what's called a clean feed system, where they will use a list of known child porn sites in Canada and block those. But I don't think we're quite seeing along with a lot of ISPs the real sense of initiative and urgency that we're seeing in the United Kingdom and a handful of other companies.
What's the reaction been to the book so far?
Well, excellent. In all accounts, I mean, not only are we getting very good reviews, and am I getting a lot of emails, but I'm speaking at a lot of important public events. I'm speaking in British Columbia at a major police academy. Judges in Manitoba have invited me to speak at the their conference. Microsoft headquarters in the United States has invited me to come down and address them. So I think people are realizing that this is not a comfortable topic. This is not a this is a disquieting, disturbing topic, but it's not one that we can ignore. This is one that people have to stand up and take recognition of and take back control of the internet. You know, it's like any crime infested neighborhood. With good public work, better policing, better laws, and especially a more alert population, we could take it back. I've posted a lot of the basic safety tips and guides for people on my website at www.julianshare.com, and people can see that there are ways they themselves can participate in fighting this.
Julian, may I ask what you're working on now?
Well, I'm actually doing a follow to this in that I am doing a documentary, a one-hour documentary for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation based on this book. I just came back from Baghdad where I did a documentary for the New York Times and the CBC, and now we're working on a one-hour documentary on this book.
It's a troubling book, but a necessary one. Julian, it's good to talk to you again. Congratulations and continued good luck with it.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you, Joseph. Thank